Board of Commissioners meeting, a little levity to begin with, and for those who may have picked up on the last of the laughter in our recorded thing, just a little fun between the Huskies and the Ducks that are present, and the outcome of the football game last weekend. And so used to do a lot of consulting. I'd walk into places, and one of the things that indicated a healthy culture was laughter. So I think we've achieved that for the day. Well, welcome to everyone. This is the Board of Commissioners for Swink County PUD. At the head table is our general manager, Steve, and our staff. And please, if you have cell phones, put them in a position that will not interfere with the meeting. And you're welcome to address at the appropriate time the commission, should you choose to do so. And because our meetings are recorded, please state your name, your address, and we'll give you a reasonable time to express your opinion or express your need. With that being said, we will open our regular meeting, our business, non-business study session this morning with a Pledge of Allegiance and a Safety Minute by Kimberly Craig.
I
pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning, commissioners and audience. I'm Kimberly Craig. I work in communications, and I'm here to talk to you about October, which is National Fire Prevention Month, and last week was National Fire Prevention Week. I have a sheet, and I'll pass that along for you. We'll refer to that in a minute. Annual observances like National Fire Prevention Week and Month are excellent opportunities to focus on fire hazards. However, it's really something that we need to do every day, and we need to do it at home and at work and at play. So if you're looking for a little help with tips, there's a great website, a National Fire Safety website, at NFPA.org, National Fire Prevention Association.org. They remind everyone in every day to do three things: to look for places that fires could start, to listen for the sound of a smoke alarm, and to learn at least two ways out of every room, and making sure that all doors and windows leading outside open easily and are free of clutter. They also have excellent tip sheets on more than a dozen subjects available in many languages. And looking ahead to conference and holiday schedule, I wanted to focus on tips for hotel and motel safety.
Go ahead.
And that's the sheet that I brought for you today. There were a couple things that were new to me on that. And one was to choose a hotel or motel that is protected by both smoke alarms and a fire sprinkler system. When you check in, ask the front desk what the fire alarm sounds like. And then also, when you get to your room, take time to find the exits. And this was the tip that made sense to me. Count the number of doors between your room and the exit. And also test that exit. Make sure it's unlocked. And if not, call the manager immediately to report it. And just a little final reminder, daylight saving time will end on November 4th. And that's a great time to check the batteries on your smoke detectors at home. Can I answer any questions?
Just a comment. I'd never been through an alarm at a motel. And about a month ago, Joyce Lynn and I were staying at a hotel in Seattle. And they're doing some significant remodeling. And a welder, late in the afternoon, just about dinner time, quitting time, ended up touching off a small fire. And it was purely amazing. You could not have missed the alarm or the directions or anything else. The other thing you just always kind of keep in mind, when you're checking in, it gets harder and harder to fight a fire above the seventh floor. So we always try and get some room at seventh floor or lower. Just some thought.
Thank you.
Timely. Very good. Commission, let's take a look at the agenda. What are your thoughts, please?
I have no changes.
Okay. So with that being said, we'll approve the agenda as presented. Let's go to number three. General Manager Steve Wright, please.
So this is our monthly cycle of personal ownership winners discussion. And this one's a particularly good one, I think, because I want to call Randy Pauly and Angela Kirshner up to the table, if they would, please, to be recognized. So Randy and Angela, of course, are basically our IT folks, but they're very focused on trying to protect against cybersecurity risk. And I just want to remind folks, cybersecurity is a huge risk, not just for the district, but for our country as a whole. Recall that the primary way the Russians got into the Ukrainian power system and shut it down was through cyber phishing. So this is the the email that comes in that is directly targeted at trying to get people to click and then allowing access into a system that ultimately can be used for nefarious purposes. So they have, for a number of years here, been basically testing by sending out emails to our employees that are fake cyber phishing attempts and then trying to figure out how many people are clicking on those and continue to work with them. Over the course of the last 4 years, they also have been steadily increasing the difficulty so that it becomes a little bit harder and harder to recognize what's coming in. Just want to share with you the numbers. So in 2015, 27% of those cyber phishing attempts were successful. Successful in the sense of that someone did click on them, unfortunately. 2016, it was 7%. 2017, it was 7%. So far this year, it's 2%. So we clearly are making some real progress here. And when I say we, I want to point to these two folks in particular, because they're the ones that have been on the front lines. Candidly, not everyone was excited when they got caught the first time. And that created some challenges for them in terms of managing inside our workforce. And I just want to just commend them for being diligent about this, being committed to something that's really important, and ultimately to being successful and to climbing the ladder of accountability, saying, hey, you know, this is something that I can do that will make a difference around here. Let's see how we actually put something in place that's going to improve the performance and operational excellence of the organization. So, Randy and Angela, we want to say thank you for your work. And I think you know that you're always given the opportunity to say something to the board if you'd like to. You're not required to, but we welcome the opportunity if there's anything you'd like to share.
Just a big thank you.
One thing that Angela may not be comfortable enough to share, but you mentioned, you know, some of the risks we face, but it goes beyond just the organizational level. It affects every one of us, you know, in our personal lives, or potentially could. And that's one of Angela's focus areas, is how can we present information that'll get them thinking about how they will address things in their personal life. A lot of folks are more interested in that end of the equation than they are in, this is just a job, so to speak. So our thought was, if we can get them thinking this way at home, it's going to trickle into the workplace. But the bottom line on this, we appreciate your recognition, Steve, the support from you, from Kelly, from Greg, and certainly from you commissioners. But this is an organizational win. I mean, it's huge across the organization to go from where we were to where we are. That just, it speaks volumes about every individual here, not just us two, but thank you for the recognition.
Appreciate your work. Commissioners?
Yeah. You know, I shared with the two of you sort of jokingly before the meeting that you've got job security ongoing for forever. And that's it's not a laughing matter. It's a great appreciation from this commissioner's perspective, the value that you're bringing to the utility in terms of protecting our security, because we all know and made aware on a regular basis the challenges that we face, and so to know you've got our back, we really appreciate it. And you know, hopefully we don't ever have to have our hands slapped for clicking the wrong click, but
we don't slap.
We educate.
Oh.
I just appreciated the fact that you didn't break down on the statistics, the boards.
So he let that cat out of the bag. The commissioners are not exempt from the training, right. From the assessments.
Right.
And we treat everybody from the board level down to any of the people that have network access exactly the same.
I would only be disappointed if it was different than that.
Yeah.
Yep. So thank you very much, because the position you're in is not always a popular one. It's not like you're running for office and, you know, that type of thing. But the diligence, the depersonalization of it, the professionalism is certainly appreciated. And I cringe every year when it's like, oh, I got to go through the training to, you know, and expose that level of ignorance. But thank you for helping me. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great job. Thank you.
Item 4, Shoreline Advisory Group report.
So just a reminder that we did do a repair project down at the south shore of Lake Chelan a while ago, and that created some concerns and issues with respect to stakeholder engagement. That led to a project to work with the folks who were interested in that to think through our stakeholder engagement processes, and this is a report on the outcome of that group's efforts. So Andy Wendell and Jenna Rahm will be presenting.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners. Andrew Wendell, Director of Customer Service, and I have with me Jenna Rahm. She's our outreach specialist. Jenna, this is the first time I think that Jenna has been in front of the Board of Commission. Jenna has been with the Chelan PUD for about a little over a year now, and her background is in stakeholder engagement. She's worked over in the Seattle metropolitan area for a number of years doing that work, and we were lucky enough to hire her about a year ago to help us out. The fact that she's a Chelan resident helps that, so she's very familiar with Chelan County and the history here. So please welcome Jenna. Also, I just would like to recognize some of the folks in the audience today. Mike and Karen Wade, who were part of the customer outreach team on this topic, as well as Norm Gutzweiler in the back there. So welcome to our public. I just want to start with echoing Steve's introduction. Really, this effort stemmed from, you know, really an internal recognition that our facility modification, you know, and our outreach process is associated with some of our larger capital projects. That policy and our processes don't necessarily meet changing customer expectations with how we applied that policy in the past. Additionally, there's, you know, growing interest in a number of areas, including preserving scenic corridors and customers' values around that. And then we've got the Shoreline Management Act, which there's new emphasis in that area from a governmental perspective, and we need to adjust some of our process to make sure we're incorporating that, in managing our process associated with the Shoreline Act. So Jenna and some internal folks assembled this team, and today we're here to report on the findings of that. They're somewhat in their raw form, and so these are really the team's recommendations, and you're welcome to field any questions that you might have there. So go ahead.
Good morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
So really quickly, just the topics we'll be covering. Andy kind of covered the background. We've got the community advisory group members, the charter that they were formed under, and then the crux of it is really the overall themes and recommendations that came out of that group, and then what our next steps are as the PUD staff. This presentation is informational, so it's really just a summary of that group's recommendation. So background, Andy covered most of this, but kind of late last year during the Shoreline Management Plan process at the county, the board requested that we convene this stakeholder group. So we formed a community advisory group, and we held 3 meetings kind of in the late spring, early summer months, and then throughout the summer sort of finalized the recommendations document that we sent out to you. Here's a list of the community advisory group members. And as Andy introduced, that we've got a handful of them here in the room today. We got a good kind of cross-section of people from throughout the county. So we were really hoping to get some representation of different viewpoints or different values that customers might have. And the group's charter originally was to learn about existing PUD policies and sort of our lessons learned on previous projects, identify information needs that they need from us, so clarifications about our policies or any resources they need from us in order to sort of work through some of these recommendations, develop stakeholder engagement guidelines or recommendations for PUD projects in the shoreline management area, and then present those recommendations to the Board of Commissioners, which is what we're doing today. Some of the overall themes of the recommendations and sort of our discussions throughout those three meetings were we did a lot of work presenting sort of some of the progress that we've made just in the last handful of years, including, you know, bringing Tika on as a customer outreach specialist, hiring me in the last year, and some of those best practices that we've pulled together in that time. So one of the themes was to continue our current outreach best practices that we've started implementing and carry those forward in the future. Identify and incorporate customer values into our projects beyond just operational benefits. So really conducting that outreach with an ear to what's important to the community when we're doing these projects besides just the electrical reliability piece. Extending these recommendations outside of the shoreline management area. So the group was really convened under the topic of the shoreline management plan, but the longer we got conversing about these topics, the more it became apparent that a lot of these recommendations and these values can expand to the entire county, not just to that specific area. And then consider implementing the near, mid, and long-term recommendations that are laid out in the next part of the presentation. So some of the near-term, I say near-term or in progress, because some of these we actually developed for the group as a working document while we were running through the meetings, is to maintain a future projects map on the website that could maybe have our five-year plan projects or some kind of look forward into the next 5 or 10 years of what we think we might be doing as far as capital work. And we sort of constructed that map for the group as part of our process using our five-year plan projects and sort of overlaying that with the asset lifespan of some of the other assets in our system going out to 10 years and 20 years. Conduct outreach each year when the five-year plan is updated. So just trying to give people an earlier notification about what we might be doing in their area so they have a little more time to think through what the impacts of a project like that might be. Create resources to help stakeholders navigate the facility modification policy. So this is one where we found we do have an existing policy to allow stakeholders to make aesthetic improvements if they wish to. And that's the facility modification policy. And it is actually used quite a bit by customers. Where it gets a little tricky is if you have a larger capital project, the policy is a little more difficult to navigate in that environment. Or if you have more than one stakeholder trying to make a facility modification, it gets a little bit tricky. So just trying to come up with some kind of step-by-step resources that help walk people through that process. Share these recommendations with franchise holders, cable and telecom companies, and permitting agencies. We spent a lot of time talking through what our franchise agreements look like, what the rules are for us operating in the right-of-way, how we interface with pole attachers and other entities. And so just sharing all of the information that we got from this group with those other entities that also work with us in these areas. And then list our upcoming capital projects in the Connected newsletter. So some of the midterm suggestions, these are kind of couched as midterm because they would take a little bit more lead time if we were to implement them, probably a little more thinking through staff resources, and just having the right project come up to implement them if we were to do so. So one of them is to create a sensitive areas map that includes existing designated areas, maybe like the scenic highways, the shoreline management area, protected wetlands, things like that overlaid on a map so that when we have a project come up in that area, we already know some of the things that we might be interfacing with as far as permitting or even just existing customer values or areas that are, valued by people in general. Explore potential funding partnerships for infrastructure, undergrounding, or other improvements. So this could be like nonprofits or grant opportunities, abilities to maybe work with the municipality to put things underground that might be in a more aesthetically sensitive area. develop creative alternatives for improving aesthetics. This could be just kind of creative design alternatives for some of our infrastructure that, I don't know, could be painted or designed differently or put, you know, halfway underground, something like that. And then continue engaging other agencies in these initiatives at the annual agency planning meetings. So the longer term strategic concepts are sort of the ones that we really want to highlight for the board as something that the group had hoped to elevate to the strategic planning level. It sort of felt like some of these strategic concepts were a little bigger than the scope of what this stakeholder group was convened to do. And so some of those recommendations might include identifying projects or areas where aesthetic improvements might be made, integrating these customer values around aesthetics or environmentally sensitive areas or topics like that into our district-wide planning, like beyond just customer utilities, and exploring funding mechanisms for undergrounding or other identified aesthetic improvements in the county. So some next steps, we're going to continue to integrate this feedback into our existing outreach best practices, evaluate these recommendations and determine the scope, feasibility, and resource needs in order to carry out some of these recommendations. And we're already starting to look at that even just in our 2019 work planning, and then present staff recommendations to the board at a future commission meeting. Thank you. Any questions?
I could add one thing real quick. I think the recommendations certainly get to a number of really interesting and valuable things that I think our stakeholders could get out of our processes. Recall that we have a set of decision evaluation criteria that we use for any significant decisions. We look at the financial implications, legal ramifications, impacts on the environment, impacts on stakeholders, and ultimately also what's the impact on our workforce. And I think one of the things that we want to do, I want to emphasize that last slide that Jenna spoke to, is just going through and saying some of these recommendations could be interpreted in various ways, some of which relatively small workload impact and some of which could be a very large workload impact. And I think we want to get better definition of that, because one of the things that we need to do is to make sure that as we think through our resource planning for 2019, that we are adequately resourcing this effort. So if we say, yes, we're going to commit to these recommendations, that in fact we got the resources to back it up to make sure that we actually are doing what we say we're going to do. And so we're not to that point yet to be able to make that resource assessment, but we hope to do that soon.
Commissioner? Ann?
I just have a question about the community advisory group. Curious how they were selected.
Yeah, so we tried to find a good representation geographically from throughout the county. So some of it was recommendations from board members, from other people we had already tapped for the advisory group, telling us, oh, I know someone who lives in this area that might want to do it. People we've worked with on other advisory group processes. In Chelan, for downtown Chelan, we got a recommendation from the mayor there in Chelan. So it was kind of just putting feelers out in a lot of different ways to try and get as much geographic diversity as we could.
Good. But I think diversity in all areas is critically important. You know, we all, when we go to put together an advisory group, we all know who the business leaders are and who the pillars of the community are, and we're quick to grab those names, and we do need some of those, but we also need, you know, we have some really bright, talented folks in Chelan who really fly under the radar, and they have a different perspective than the business leaders. And so my hope is that you have a really broad representation of folks from all walks of life, because this is so important. Mm-hmm. And it's not just, you know, it's so important to all the people, not just the people who have homes on the lake.
Mm-hmm. I think perhaps a partial response, Commissioner Congdon, to your comments is that there's kind of a flow that is developing here from the outreach process and the identification of what you people have done, I think, well. Kind of next flowing into the strategic planning process. And I think, Commissioner Congdon, that's an opportunity for additional citizens of all locations in Chelan County in all walks of life and how they view things to be able to become actively involved in helping us through the strategic planning process to develop more fully, ultimately leading to a policy that's not so rigid that it paints staff and everybody else into a corner or pigeonholes a particular segment of the community, but a policy that is general enough to allow us to continue to get input in terms of what is important, as well then as to be able to look at the financial requirements of those desires and ways of funding those. So there's, I think that next natural step is kind of an expansion of this opportunity through the strategic planning process. And I guess I would suggest being an advocate to some of those who maybe have a different point of view, that this might be the opportunity to express that view, and you know, whether it's in Chelan or Indiana or Malaga or wherever in the county, so that we have across the board view of what's important to us. And because I think this is really important, and I just look at, you know, the values that are being expressed, and at what level, at what rate are people willing to support that view in terms of the, you know, the funding. And, you know, most anything's possible as long as you can write the check to cover it. So, again, appreciate the work, Wade, the work of you, Norm, others involved in bringing this forward. And I think we're in the initial stages with a ways to go. But the commitment from the board is we're going to make that effort and get this where it needs to be. Yeah.
So may I just follow up with a question? So I got to quit thinking about that darn Husky. Darn. So what, Dennis, did you say? What would that next step be, which gives us an opportunity to bring in more and a broader cross-section of participation? What is that next step?
I think through the strategic planning process that we're just now really getting into for the next 5 years.
The focus group kind of a thing?
Like we did before with people showing different interest in different areas. It'll give them the opportunity to say the aesthetics of how we distribute our electricity and our utilities is a valuable piece. And a highly valued piece. I'd really like to be a part of that, you know, and have an opportunity for input. And I think structurally through that outreach process of the strategic plan that will be provided. And our attorney is shaking his head yes, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wouldn't interpret that as anything specific.
Yeah.
So I think that there is that opportunity, and that is one of the questions that will be posed in strategic planning. How we handle some of those growth pace for growth policies and aesthetic issues.
And maybe this is a moment just to do a quick update on strategic planning, because we haven't talked about it in public session for a while. But our plan at this point is to try to initiate that beginning in December. We have more materials we need to bring to you, because part of this is the decision about what are the key issues that we want to highlight and ask for input on. And we expect those to be roughly about a half dozen or so. So it takes some prioritization in terms of thinking that through. Based on the feedback that we've heard from this group, that we've heard from the board, we are anticipating that one of the issues that we would propose for your consideration is the aesthetics issue and the trade-off against cost. That, to be able to engage that with the county. So again, it'll be your choice as to what those priorities are, but I would expect us to begin that conversation probably in late November sometime.
So Steve, calling it the aesthetic, so that's going to be the umbrella term for, which includes undergrounding, the undergrounding issue for sure.
Yeah. Substations.
So we think that it's probably both, that it's undergrounding and substation. Yeah. It really has to do with generally around anything around transmission distribution, but those are certainly the two big ones.
Yeah. Thank you.
Excuse me. Other thoughts, comments, questions? Thank you.
Public comment?
Well, I think that's appropriate. Thank you, Randy.
Anybody?
Well, I'd just like to say thanks to the...
Here, let me give you this mic.
And Mike Wade.
Oh, she turned it off. I'd help you with that, but I might not be able to figure it out. Somebody needs to turn it on that knows how to turn it on. I still have books in my office, Mike.
There we go.
All right. Technology. No, I just wanted to be here to show support and thanks for to the board members. And I know a lot of time and energy went into the work that Jenna did. And to me, it is, as you've already talked about here, it was kind of a 1-2 punch. The first was talking about the outreach and how improvements could be made. And I think we identified that, and I'm excited to see those things in process. And secondly, it's just as Steve said, it's your strategic 5-year planning, and I just look forward to another robust discussion on that topic. So, again, appreciate it. I know you guys have lots of balls in the air, and just, again, appreciate the time you put into this.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
No harm, no way.
Thanks, Karen.
This is like a reunion.
Any other thoughts, comments? Mike, thank you very much. We'll move on then to quarterly electrical load.
Thank you.
Growth
thank
update.
You. This will be easy because Andy gets to stay. He's going to be joined by Chad Rissman. Recall this is the, we've now instituted this practice of quarterly discussing what's going on with load growth in the county.
Thank you, and good morning, Commissioners. Chad Rissman, Director of Asset Management and the Distribution Side and Engineering, and joined by my colleague, Andy Wendell, Director of Customer Service. Interesting, this next topic here that we're coming up with is actually upstream from the previous topic, right? So appreciate the opportunity to continue the conversation and keep on the radar load growth and the ramifications to infrastructure improvements and requirements in order to maintain reliability in the distribution and substation network and system. Just a little bit of a anchoring back to what we're trying to do here is when load growth occurs and infrastructure, there's infrastructure requirements, there's obviously choices around where and what gets built and at what time frame and what the reliability choices are, but we wanted to keep on the radar some of these things that are coming at us so that we can understand a little bit sooner when we may need something in the future and start planning around that. So this quarterly update to the board on load growth and infrastructure requirements and efforts related to that, how we're doing proactive planning with others, seeking options on properties and siting, and coordinating those efforts with the governing municipalities and also the county. And then how we engage the public and other stakeholders in siting and planning for infrastructure. So today's agenda, not a lot is new. We are experiencing pretty high growth. In fact, the strongest growth here in 2018 is related to construction. There's a lot of construction activities that are going on out there. Construction takes a while, so a lot of the loads that we've been planning are in the application process has not changed much since the last quarterly update, although it is significant. So just wanted to touch on those things quickly, but I wanted to save more time to talk about some of the siting processes and feasibilities going on around identifying options and feasibilities of siting in particular future substations. So Andy's going to talk about that and also some agency planning, cryptocurrency, zoning type activities that have been going on. So this is a list that we brought to you the last couple of times about new loads that are in the queue, per se, that folks have applied for. This has not changed from the last time. Like I said, construction activities take a while. And so we're still looking on onboarding. You can see that some of these are online now and others are coming. We have a meeting later on this week, I think, with the customer in Chelan. It might be bring some new loads going on in Chelan that are not on this list related to fruit warehousing. So maybe a few megawatts there that we'll be adding to the list next time. So we're trying to find out a little bit more about that. But that's a coming attraction. The next slide is the same representation, really, of what those loads are, just looking at them geographically. I'll note a couple of things on here. It says down there July 9th was updated. It's actually the update in October here. We forgot to update the date on that. Thought we had an average megawatt on here, but I just want to point out that we're trying to stick with megawatts here because we're really looking at peaks rather than energy, difference between peaks and energy. The peaks are really what we need to ensure that we have the right infrastructure in place. So substations and distribution transmission lines are really related to the peaks, not necessarily the energy. Again, 10-year load forecast. We have a load forecasting team here that meets frequently. In fact, we have another update meeting this week. As you recall, our peak consumption time is during the winter. So through the summer months, we don't get empirical information, but we're coming into the winter months, so we'll get a little bit more empirical information and be able to provide some more updates probably through the winter time. But nothing's changed here. Again, it says the average megawatts probably should be megawatts. We're talking about peaks in here. With that, I'll pass it over to Andy. He spent a little bit of time talking about long-range planning and the efforts that we're doing, particularly in the substation siting arena.
Thanks, Chad. So with respect to long-range planning, we're trying to apply a lot of lessons learned over our history. And what we've recognized is certainly part of our long-range planning is to look externally to the municipalities and the counties and really engage them, their planners, and ensure that their comprehensive plans include that critical utility infrastructure component. So we are continuing to have great discussions with the municipalities in terms of long-range planning. One of the things that we need to do, you're getting that three-year view as far as customer growth and expansion, and although that's very important, we're looking beyond 3 years. We're trying to look out that 20 and 50-year views from infrastructure. And as we all know, these substations have a 40-year, 50-year, 60-year life associated with them. So it's important that we try to incorporate that long-term view. Identifying the load by zone. And as we know, we've got traditional zones, commercial, industrial, residential zones. But with the introduction of the new cryptocurrency commerce and high-density loads into our zoning areas, it's more important now than ever to reevaluate the energy consumption per zones and to make sure that we're calibrating our assumptions well with the municipalities and what they're talking about from energy use in the particular zones. One of the most effective things that we've been able to do through this process is just get a better understanding of where our infrastructure limitations are. Obviously, capacity and transmission and distribution lines and substations have a limited capacity. It's not finite. And so we're learning very quickly where our weaknesses are and where our strengths are in those particular areas. And then we're able to have good conversations about future infrastructure requirements to not only resolve the limitations we have today, but try to meet the future demands in the future. And then taking that step forward to talk a lot more about the siting of the substations, the timing, and the potential impacts to the communities, including aesthetics. But that's more of a partnership perspective rather than us just charging forward on our own. This map in front of you, this is for illustrative purposes, but the green boxes show our existing substations. The green lines that connect those is the transmission network as it exists today. And when Chad and his engineers, when we look into that crystal ball, that 20 to 50 year view, we're identifying the need for about 14 more substations. And those are representative of the red boxes on the map. You can see they are distributed widely across the county. Those areas are not to be construed as specific locations for substations. They're just general areas. And so you can see that's a significant increase in total number of substations. These are substations that we're focused in at this point in time. And the top six on that list is shown in this slide here. We've got the north shore of Lake Chelan. As we all know, that we were successful in acquiring property there. We're still doing some feasibility in the design process up there. Same in the city of Leavenworth. We went through that property acquisition process. What we're calling OMI, or the Old Station area. This is adjacent to the Stamilt facilities out in Old Station. We were successful in recently acquiring property there. We're continuing to work on that. As well as a few weeks ago, you approved the purchase of the property in the North Eniat city area. And today we own the title to that property. So we're moving forward there. The next two targeted areas are areas that are very important to us from a capacity limitation standpoint. The Wenatchee downtown corridor has got some significant limitations to our capacity, and we're seeing growth and expansion occurring in that particular area, as well as continued growth and expansion in the South Shore Lake Chelan area. It's important to note that although the North Shore has a lot of growth and expansion going on, there's limited value to that new substation on the north when we take a look at everything going on the south side of the shore. So we are looking at the feasibility of a new substation located in the vicinity of the South Shore of Lake Chelan as well. Just an example of what that looks like. On this particular photo, you're seeing the, of course, the Columbia River, South Worthen Street, and this is our existing, this area here is our existing substation and 115 transfer switch yard. These breakers here are the distribution breakers. This is essentially the substation component of it. One of the things that we do in a feasibility, in addition to looking at alternative properties, is we look to see what we can do with the existing properties that we currently have. And in this particular case, the feasibility looks something like this, where we would essentially build a second substation and breakers and a new 115 tap, the transmission tap shown here coming into the new breaker set. But in doing so, backing up here, you can see that that extends over onto this neighboring property here. So the feasibility right now is to engage that property owner to determine if we can work out a property acquisition that would help us build that out. This would make significant improvements for the long term in the downtown corridor. So that's an example of what we're going through at this point in time. And we're doing the same thing in the Chelan area, and we'll bring back more information about the South Shore when that information is available. So moving on, looking forward, obviously we're continuing our work with the county and the municipal entities, and both on the long-term growth and expansion, as well as taking a look at that cryptocurrency zoning and what we should be doing there. We're very active in that conversation right now, in particular with the city of Wenatchee, as well as Chelan County. So the last time I spoke to you about that, we had made several engagements with the commissions and their planning commissions, and we're in the process right now of reviewing some draft language for cryptocurrency zoning. So we'll bring that forward here hopefully soon. Regular updates, of course, to you as well as the other commissions, I think, is paramount in our actions moving forward. Specific to the cryptocurrency zoning, I think what we can anticipate as an outcome is somewhat restrictions on cryptocurrency zoning, or excuse me, cryptocurrency in the residential zones, and that's to ensure we're preserving the reliability and safety of our electric system. So I think we can anticipate some language that would either eliminate or restrict crypto in the residential homes. However, on the commercial industrial area, I think there is some interest in allowing cryptocurrency zoning, but also limiting that crypto growth so that we can ensure that our non-crypto traditional customers can continue to connect during this time that we are assessing our limited infrastructure capacities. So that's something that we've heard loud and clear from the municipalities as well as the counties, ensure that we can connect up the schools, the hospitals, the residential housing developments, in addition to the crypto where we can. So we'll likely see some language just very specific to some limits or some caps within those particular zones. So with that, that concludes the discussion today. I know that was kind of a lot of different topics, but we're happy to field whatever questions that you have.
Commissioner Randy.
Yeah, one of the things that hit me as you went through this, but nice presentation, by the way, and I think I, as a commissioner, always appreciate looking down the road to see what we're going to be doing, not just this year, but 2, 5, 10, and longer years. The last two pages of your presentation, it really hit me how incredibly valuable the entity that we've put together over the last 10 years, the Tri-Commission, has become in terms of not only spreading the word of what we're doing, but having an ability to have a conversation in a regular setting. And so as you plan on your spreading the word, I'm assuming that you will continue to utilize that venue that we have created that I think is so valuable for our county. It's not just the PUD, it's not just the county, it's not just the port, but it's the cities, it's all of the above. And there's a great platform there to have knowledge spread out as we move forward. So thanks for what you're doing, and just keep that in mind.
Anyone else? Gentlemen, thank you.
I'd like to just add one quick thought, which is load forecasts have consequences, and they have consequences in terms of infrastructure investment. So there's going to be a nice connection here between this presentation and particularly the page that described all of the various projects that are going on, and then the budget implications of that that flow out of that too.
So all of those projects probably won't be completed in 2019?
I would say probably not, probably. I would say definitely. It's a lot. Are you talking about the new customers, or are you talking about the 14
long substations? Long list?
Yeah, the 14 substations. And where we're focused right now is acquiring as the siting piece, and acquiring the property, and maybe moving into permitting, as we've recognized or identified that sometimes those are challenging, and can extend the timeline. But once we have an idea of where the location is, then we can move into design and construction almost immediately. And we have some options around contracting and various options. So there's a lot of choices that Steve was alluding to there of how fast we can extend these stations out. Do we want to build as we grow? What kind of position do we want to choose as far as available capacity?
So what I was actually referring to was the active customer projects that are 30 megawatts.
Mm.
Knowing that our normal load is around 200 or a little more, and that represents over 10% growth, I was making the assumption these probably won't all be concluded by some of them will be concluded this year in 18, some in 19, probably some the year after that.
Correct. Yeah, the column in the middle there is when we would anticipate some of that load coming online. And I would just emphasize, too, that that's peak energy. So, we likely wouldn't see an additional 30 megawatts rolling into our average annual average there.
But we would need 30 megawatts of capacity installed in order to serve those. So
January is zero, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I guess I would just add one final comment specific to Chad's point, is that generally it's a three-year planning process to get the substations put into place. The first year is the property acquisition and permitting. The second year is usually design and procurement, and then the third year is construction. By focusing on acquiring properties, we can shave 33% off the time, theoretically 33% off the time. It's our vision that we would make every attempt to try to forecast the best we can and acquire as many of the red boxes on this map as possible in the near term, so that we can push on the gas or the brakes, whichever is needed when we get there.
Great. Good forward thinking.
Thank you.
Nice segue.
And next up, we'll talk about 2019 budget targets and major assumptions. Craig Coons and Deborah Vaughn will be presenting for us.
Good morning, commissioners. Deborah's out of the office today. I'll be sitting in for Deborah this morning. Craig Coons, manager for strategic financial planning. What we're going to cover today is the purpose, timeline, guidelines, and assumptions, and next steps in regards to the 2019 budget process. And there is no board action required today. Today's focus really is, it's primarily transitioning from the five-year business plan, which was presented on October 1st to the commission, and really trying to take that and looking at the 2019 initiatives and how that relates to our annual budget process for 2019. And this is a great slide. This is kind of trying to put everything in together, where we look at the highest levels, the district's mission and vision, and we look at our strategic plan goals. We get the five-year business planning cycle, and we get the district's five-year business plan. And from that district's five-year business plan, we start to focus on 2019 to look at our 2019 initiatives and goals and objectives. And that's where we start creating the annual budget for 2019, and that's where we're here today. We're not going to get into a lot of numbers. We're just going to get into the major assumptions, timelines, and so forth, which leads me to the next slide. So the business plan was presented to the board on October 1st. And again, we're just talking about the budget overview, timelines, and assumptions today. On November 5th and November 19th, we'll have public hearings to go over the facts and figures associated with the 2019 budget. And we'll come to the board on December 3rd requesting a budget approval. And the foundation of our budget and our strategic plan is the top of our balanced scorecard, which is customer owner's satisfaction. And the primary goals are investing in our assets and people. It's our highest priority, and it's followed by maintaining a debt ratio below 35% and continuing with the public power benefit program. Looking at our primary priority is investing in our core assets and people. This information is going to look very similar to what you received on October 1st. This is just highlighting in regards to looking at all the initiatives with the five-year business plan. This is really highlighting our 2019 district initiatives. In particular, you'll notice a lot of investments in our hydros and our CIS customer information system. Look at the next slide. I would highlight the implementing the long-term planning strategic plan for facilities, and continuing with a lot of core investments and a lot of other core activities. So we got a lot on the plate for 2019 related to reinvesting in our core assets and our people. Looking at our other priorities, we're going to continue to focus on paying down debt. And we're going to achieve the debt ratio of less than 35 in 2018, which you've heard before. And we'll continue to maintain that ratio out in 2019. And we'll continue to look for debt reductions, opportunities, and other ways to optimize our debt portfolio during the year. And we'll continue with our public power benefit program. Looking at some early external indicators that really influence some of our results and our budget assumptions, as you're well aware, the wholesale revenue electric market continues to be lower than it has in the past, but we are starting to see some indications that it's starting to improve as we look forward. With that in mind, we're focusing a lot of our efforts and investments for projects with the highest long-term customer value, in particular the investments out at the hydros, both Reach and Rock Island. And an influencing factor, as was just mentioned earlier, we continue to monitor the low growth patterns in our customer profiles as they influence not only our infrastructural needs, capital investments, they have direct impacts to our revenue from the retail electric side of the house. Looking at our 2019 targeted financial policies, currently our 2019 forecast and our budget, as we develop it, we're meeting all of our district's financial policies for 2019, as shown in this our targets here. The one item I would note is liquidity. It's shown as a target in 2019 of greater than $184 million. Normally, we show that as $175 million. But the policy is written that we set it at the greater of our calculated reserve requirement, or $175 million. And for 2019, we have significant capital investments. And due to that, when we calculate our required reserve, it's bumped that up to about $184 million currently. So that will be our forecasted number until things change. Because right now in 2019, without getting into the details, we're looking at north of $150 million of capital investment. Looking at some key budget assumptions, when we look at the wholesale revenue, we assume average flows and current forward price curve. System load growth, this is where I want to be clear in regards to the previous presentation. This is looking at energy consumption, not necessarily when they were talking about peak load requirements for infrastructure investment. For the electric system, we're looking at about 4.5% net of conservation energy consumption increase for 2019. 2% of that's basically driven by retail electric organic load growth, and we see about a 60% increase in what I would consider the HDL slash crypto load growth that we hear so much about. We assume about a 2% increase in water and 1.5% increase in wastewater, and we're looking at about 1,100 new fiber installations. 750 of those new installations will be under our current service territory, and about 350 will be under the public power benefit territory that we're developing or will be expanding into for 2019. Looking at our business line service revenues, we have no electric rate increases in the 2019 budget. We do, however, have a 2% increase in water rates and a 5% increase in wastewater rates that will be effective April 1st of 2019. This will be the last year of the multi-year plan that was established by the board in 2015. And the fiber rate structure reflects our current rate structure. Our revenue for 2019 budget reflects our current rate structure for fiber. And I would go back to the electric load growth. You know, as Chad mentioned, the load group meets, and if they make any adjustments, we'll reflect that in our budget and our forecast as we get new information. Looking at the labor, for our bargaining unit, there is a 3% general wage increase in the budget, and that will be effective April 1st, 2019, and that's per the collective bargaining agreement. For the non-bargaining unit, the budget includes assumptions for merit increases, market adjustments, and promotions, but all final decisions will be informed by actual market data. It's kind of a situation where we put an assumption in there, and then as we get more information, we make the adjustments going for non-bargaining unit labor. And just to highlight long-term cost plus, just a couple of the major items. The debt reduction charge is still maintained at 3%, and the capital recovery charge is at 50%. Those are the main two cost, the plus contract assumptions we have in regards to the cost plus contracts. A couple of other big assumptions are capital and operating expenditures. Those are driven by our 2019 through 2023 business plan focused on 2019. And there are some substantial investments in regards to Rock Island, Rocky Reach, CIS, Strategic Facilities Plan. Those are driving a lot of our capital and O&M expenditures for 2019. Regards to the debt, we have a $41 million of planned principal payment on our, so we'll be paying $41 million of planned debt. I would note that there is the potential, and it will probably be in the presentation, that we are looking at having a low-interest loan, Public Works Trust Fund loan, related to the Shaston wastewater plant. So although we'll be paying $41 million, we might have an additional $2.5 million of new debt. We assume interest earnings estimate at 2.4%. As the Fed continues to make adjustments, we might monitor that, make adjustments going forward through the budgeting process. And we'll continue with the public power benefit investments. So with that, again, it's a high level, just timelines and major assumptions. What we're going to do is we're going to continue with the budgeting process. All the business units are developing their budgets, analyzing it, make sure it's in alignment with the business plan. We will continue to review and make the modifications needed. And a budget hearing on November 5th, we'll give you the detailed numbers and facts and figures related to that. Make any corrections or adjustments we need to do as we get more information. Meet again on the 19th of November. Then we'll be coming to the board on December 3rd for a formal budget approval. And with that, I'll ask any questions or comments.
Randy.
Yeah, back to our proposed capital expenditures for 2019. Did you say that number was $130 million?
No, I believe it's north of $150 million. And again, this is just going to be based on what we currently have in the forecast. And the reason it's changed a little bit, probably from the October 1st presentation, if we gave you those numbers, is we did have a slight modification where we deferred a little bit of work that was being done at Rock Island and moved it into 2019. So I believe that I can give you the exact, I think it's $152 million currently, okay. Gross capital expenditure. And as we continue to look at that, but that is really driven, between 2018 and 2019, the total capital really didn't change. It just kind of got deferred moved around a little bit.
And has there, I don't know if anybody's even looked, but has there ever been a year that we've had capital expenditures that large from the beginning of our utility?
We've looked back 20 years.
Yeah. I was going to say 2018 was when we adopted that. That was basically the highest we've had been in a few years. And then that was at $140 million. And now we're looking at $152 million currently. So, yeah, we continue to make major significant investments, and we have a large capital program. And, again, the timing may change, but in the last 20 years, we're in a very peak, planned, coordinated effort to invest in our assets.
Yeah, if my memory serves me correctly, our total outstanding debt when we built Rocky Reach, I'm betting these are the biggest numbers ever.
I think there's probably a good chance of that because of inflationary factors, if nothing else, going back to the 1960s. But I do want to note that we are pretty substantially under in terms of our spending for this year. In fact, you'll see that in the third quarter review. Part of that is what Craig spoke to, that some of the challenges at Rock Island are causing us not to be able to complete the work as quickly as we would like, and that's spilling over into next year. So you're seeing some increase just as a carryover from spending that was planned for this year that we're not going to be able to accomplish moving into next year. We'll also be doing an update for you generally on Rock Island and how we're doing down there sometime probably in the next couple of meetings.
All right, I look forward to giving you the numbers on November 5th.
Thank you, Craig.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good.
Nice lanyard.
Yeah, I'm still, might have been off my game. I'm still
get a therapy cookie.
They're probably all gone by now.
Ann's had to have two.
No, I've only had one. I'm being good.
All right, next up, we want to talk to you about our strategy, basically, for the modernization of cranes down at Rock Island. And recall that we've already been through a big set of projects at Rocky Reach, so we'll talk a little about what we learned from that and how we're applying it at Rock Island. Brett Bickford will present.
Good morning. I'm Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management, and this morning I'd like to present a staff recommendation to revise the scope and the budget for the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 intake gantry and bridge cranes. Through the presentation, I'd like to go over our project objectives, talk about some lessons learned from the Rocky Reach crane projects, review a staff recommendation on how to proceed with refurbishment of these, talk about some pros, cons, and risks of that recommendation, review the budget, and then talk about some next steps. So the Rock Island Powerhouse 2 cranes consist of the gantry crane, shown here in this photo. It's a 250-ton gantry crane. It also includes one bridge crane in the powerhouse. Both of these cranes are all original, built during construction and used to install the generating units. The project team, working with operations and Crane consultants, have come up with a set of project objectives to help guide the project. The primary one is to restore full functions of the cranes. Currently, the bridge crane has control system issues, and so it's not able. We're not able to use the 250-ton hoist used for equipment disassembly. We want to significantly improve safety and access for our operations and maintenance personnel. We want to try to minimize the cost and schedule impacts from the unknowns that arise during construction, depending on what type of approach we take with refurbishment. We want to minimize crane downtime. We've got a lot of work at Rock Island Powerhouse 2 that's backed up, and so when these cranes are down, we can't perform very significant work at all in the powerhouse. We want to minimize the impact to our other projects. We want to try to maximize our warranty and our design life, and we want to leverage those lessons learned that we've had on our recent crane projects at Rocky Reach. So I'd like to start with our lessons learned at from Rocky Reach. In this picture, you can see in the foreground is our brand new intake gantry crane. In the background is our old original gantry crane before it was removed. We bid that project with the option to refurbish that crane. We also bid an option for an all new. We went with the all new option because it was only about $200,000 more than refurbishment. As we executed that contract, we had about $200,000 price increase from different changes in scope of the work and other things that we saw once we got it in place that we needed to add to the project. One thing we might note is there was kind of a small cost difference between refurbishment and new because the structure of the old crane was going to be required that it was all of the rivets needed to be inspected. So that crane was built in the 50s, all riveted construction. To inspect the rivets, we were going to have to completely sandblast it and then go rivet by rivet and inspect those. So that was a very high cost to do all that refurbishment and inspection. And so there wasn't really a big cost delta to go ahead and build a whole new structure. Also, there was cost in the project. When the crane was going to be down, there was going to be another large crane rented and have it on site. Because these cranes are used for emergency head deployment. And so those costs were pretty close because of those reasons. In the powerhouse, we also refurbished the two bridge cranes. As we were putting together the bid documents for that project and doing more thorough inspections to develop those bid documents, we actually found that we had significant cracks on the drums. And so we had to curtail our work in the powerhouse on generating units, and we had to take the cranes out of service, and we had to do some emergency repairs to the drums. When we first identified cracks, we thought the cost might be about $250,000, and as we removed the drums, took them in, had them completely sandblasted and inspected, we found more and more and more issues, and our total ended up being about $790,000. After the drums were reinstalled, we proceeded with our refurbishment project, and we bid that at a contract price of about $4.4 million. Through the course of that refurbishment, we found quite a bit of extra work, and that final contract price ended up at about $5.6 million, so significant cost increase. The scope for that work was refurbishment, so what that meant was that the crane would be completely disassembled. Parts would be inspected. We would only replace parts that needed to be replaced. And so we found there was a pretty significant amount of work that needed to be done, and that took a significant amount of time, which impacted other project work. So some of the actions to meet some of the objectives that I listed sooner was instead of incurring quite a bit of extra cost, downtime, between when we purchased, between refurbishing and purchasing new parts, we've come up with a proposal instead of trying to do that refurbishment of where we remove everything and inspect it and then buy just what we need, we're proposing that you could purchase new trolleys and come out ahead. The other option would be to go to the next step and also purchase all new cranes. So I'll talk about more about the costs of those two options. To meet some of our other objectives, by buying new trolleys, we can build those in the shop so it minimizes our crane downtime. Also, we can do testing in the shop because there's quite a bit of wiring and mechanical work that needs to be done through a testing process that can take up to about 6 weeks. We can also minimize downtime and work in the field. The existing cranes are welded construction. We've done some preliminary inspections. The outside crane, the gantry, does need some painting. It's pretty heavily corroded up on the surfaces that are flat that retain snow and rainwater. But we propose that we could just overcoat those to minimize downtime as opposed to completely stripping them and repainting them. There's quite a number of safety opportunities. The two cranes don't have handrails or very good platforms that allow access or maintenance or any tie-off points. And so we'd propose to add those and then also add fully functional operator's cabs. So to kind of better describe some of those different alternatives that I just mentioned is, this is the intake gantry crane. This is kind of the original layout of the equipment. These two large cylinders are the hoist, the 250 and the 70-ton hoist. And our original scope, when we originally proposed this budget based on inspections in 2013, it was again to take this structure down, completely remove the components, replace those that were damaged, do repairs. With our new approach of refurbishment, here we've shown some equipment which we think we should just go ahead and outright replace. And then you can see here some new walkways and structures that our operations folks can use to better maintain the crane. And then going all to the all-new option of a trolley, that would be primarily replacing these drums and these other blue components. We know right out of the chute that that's going to cost an extra about $500,000. And so that's what we're weighing is, do we want to go to this enhanced refurbishment option, or do we want to go for the all-new trolley with that known cost of $520? So the previous pictures, we're just looking at this red structure here. That's the trolley structure. Now looking at the gantry structure, this items in blue are new walkway handrails that we'd put up. This is new equipment that supports the electric, the new AC control system, and we would do truck refurbishment. We're not proposing for this crane that we would replace the structure because we think that's about a multi-million dollar additional cost to the project. Again, this is an all-welded structure. It doesn't have rivets. We think it's in fairly good shape and just needs some touch-up painting on these surfaces. For the bridge crane, this is the crane that's in the powerhouse. Also to note, there's only one bridge crane. It's different than Rocky Reach, which has two. So we're proposing, again, instead of the original scope, which is to take this down, inspect, replace what's necessary, is these components in red, we would just, in the bid documents, go ahead and include that they would need to be replaced. These drums would be something that would be evaluated. We would add to this structure to add a handrail and safe and improved access for safety. Or we could go to the next option of, again, replacing these drums and all the equipment. But we know that's going to cost about $420,000 more.
What's the total price? Give a relationship to.
Total price is coming up on the next couple of slides.
Okay.
So looking at the bridge crane, we just talked about the trolley structure. And then this is the bridge that the trolley travels on. This is an all-welded steel bridge. We feel it's in fairly good shape, and so we're not proposing that we would replace that. We would add handrails, this new operator's cab, and these the electrical equipment for the new AC variable frequency drive control system. So here's the cost slide. Originally, this project, again, from inspections in 2013, budgeting 2015, is we looked at what was the cost going to be to fix what was broken, primarily the control system. and then to remove everything and inspect it. And then beyond that, it would be extra cost. Based on our lessons learned from Rocky Reach, we're not recommending with that approach anymore. We want to go to the next approach where to minimize our downtime, to minimize impacts, cost changes, a number of those items that I showed in red, we would go ahead and just have those replaced. And then we would also add our safety features. And so this total cost is about $6.2 million for the gantry crane, about $4.9 million for the bridge crane. So based on some of those cost differences that we saw at Rocky Reach, schedule impacts, staff is actually recommending going to this option over here where we go ahead and say we're just going to replace both of the trolleys outright. We know that's going to cost some more in capital costs. We do reduce some of the projected O&M costs to do refurbishments, but we have some unknowns in there with those drums, like we found at Rocky Reach, and some other components. And again, at Rocky Reach, we saw about a $2 million of extra work to that contract. We also had 4 months time extension, which worked where we delayed the C8 to C11 project. We have costs that we had to pay contractors for delays on their contracts. And so what we're proposing is to try to mitigate that risk, is go ahead and buy new trolleys for both of those for that incremental cost to mitigate potential downtime, extra costs, and impacts. We have a tremendous amount of work at Rocky Reach with the new facilities. The Powerhouse 1 construction on those rehabs is still going to be ongoing. We'll be endeavoring to start the Powerhouse 2 rehab. So it's very critical that we think we minimize downtime, we minimize uncertainty in our costs. And so this is the approach that staff is recommending. Kind of summarize again, these new trolleys, we think we can save 2 months of downtime, less impacts on other projects. There's the potential costs that we had at Rocky Reach to try to mitigate, and our schedule uncertainty. And then another item to mention is warranty. When we refurbish components, we get a pretty limited warranty on that. We've been talking with the vendors. We think we might be able to get up to 5 years or even longer if we can go with new trolleys. We think that's pretty beneficial, being that we'll be going into kind of a 10-year rehab program.
So with the new trolleys, just help me understand this. Do you continue by utilizing the old trolley while you're putting in the new trolley? I mean, are they simultaneously, can they coexist, or does one have to go out before the new one comes in?
So we can coexist all the way to the point where we're going to make the change out. Mm-hmm. So it is a lot different than if we refurbish the trolley. It has to come down, has to get stripped, has to get blasted, new equipment tested. All of that part we can save, but when it comes time to actually put the new trolley up, mm-hmm. we will have to discontinue use of the other one.
Thank you.
It really takes only about a day to set it. But then there's the wiring changes that take the time. So we have to go ahead and, because of the one power feed, we have to stop the other crane, the other trolley. So yeah, there'll be about a month downtime as opposed to about 3 to 4 months downtime.
So you've identified a lot of delays that occurred with the refurbishment. I wonder if you've ever attempted to put a dollar amount on all those delays and, things that occurred by refurbishment that's not reflected here.
Yeah, the only one that I didn't mention was our impact to our Voith contract. So that was about a $360,000 impact to that schedule for the 4 month delay.
That's a big
one. It also impacted Rocky Reach maintenance activities. And so during that period, they had scheduled to do 2 maintenance outages. And so that work wasn't being able to be completed. And we also planned to put in 1 governor control system. So all of that work was deferred. And unfortunately, even today, we're still not able to catch up with that because of other issues at the plant.
Okay.
Also, our staff time to, assess those issues, develop solutions, agree with the contractor on what's the solution, come up with a revised budget, come back to the commission for field work order changes. all those are other cost impacts.
Brett, it seems like to me, when just looking at the drawings, that we made some significant improvements on safety.
And
we
yes.
We can't put a dollar amount on that, so I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so our recommendation is, you know, go with new trolleys for both of the bridge cranes, reuse the bridge structures, but to go ahead and get pricing again for overall, so we can evaluate that in terms of if the pricing is very close. We don't anticipate it will be because the steel structures are pretty massive. Again, the gantry crane at Rock Island 2 is a 250-ton. At Rocky Reach, that's only a 150, so the structure is much more substantial. And it's a much longer, bigger structure because it has to reach all the way over the powerhouse as well as the intake slots as well.
Brett, I would imagine there's not much of a market for used cranes, so do we scrap those out?
That's what we've done. We allow in the contract for the contractor to take and do whatever they want with those okay. cranes. So they take over ownership. If they find an opportunity, then hopefully they would, you know, give us a credit or something in the bid to help
okay.
them to be able to win. We give them that option.
All right. Thank you.
So this presentation, again, was just to let you know what staff is proposing to do in our upcoming bid documents. What this would require is addition of funds to the projects as currently budgeted and forecasted. And so what this would mean is it would be an additional $3.2 million for the gantry crane and $2.1 for the bridge cranes, and then additionally some O&M costs. If this approach seems reasonable, then staff would make those changes to our program schedules and our budgets. We would update our bid package to eliminate that option for complete disassembly and inspection and just go for the new trolleys. And then we'd also have a bid option for new cranes. And staff could be prepared to present a resolution to advertise bids at the next meeting.
What's the, and I may have missed it in the presentation, but what's the lifespan on a crane, 50 years?
So these ones were installed about 40 years ago.
Okay.
So we think that seems to be kind of the reasonable timeline.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Commissioner? Thanks, Brett.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, let me just add that this comes at a bit of an awkward time in the budgeting process. So if it comes outside of the budget process, then it's a change in the budget, so it comes to the board for resolution. If annually in the budget process, we update the capital projects and then the board approves the budget. So this one's going to be right on the edge as to whether we will have the information in time for to be included in the budget or whether it comes as a separate resolution later to change the budget. So I just want to make sure that's on your screen. It might come forward in a formal way separately, or it might just come forward as part of the annual budgeting process.
I think either way it works. Yeah. Aranda River Park.
I invite Michelle Smith to come up and provide an update for us on the Aranda River Park.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Michelle Smith, Director of License and Environmental Compliance. I am giving you a briefing today, so I'm going to keep this very short. But the reason we're bringing you a briefing on Arundel River Park today and not more of a full business plan that we promised back in June is primarily because we just didn't, the Port Douglas County did not get quite as far along in their work with the Recreation and Conservation Office to be able to build a business plan and bring that back today. So although we're making some very good progress and we've had a lot of good discussion moving forward, we don't have a full business plan to bring back to you right now. So I wanted to at least bring back to you a status report on what has been done, including a lot of the survey and user information that we've gathered through the summer. I did want to recognize Ron Crittlebaugh, who is in the audience today. He is the economic development manager for the Port of Douglas County. So I'm going to just quickly go over three items. One is the report on our customer and user feedback, give you a quick status on the progress that and some of the challenges that the port is facing with their RCO grant funding obligations, and then also inform you of our planned next steps next year and then towards the longer term plan. So I'm going to start out with the outreach results. We did this in two ways. We sent out a mailer early in the summer to try and at least give the local community some information about park operations, how things were changing, and then also a contact so that they had someone to reach out to if they had questions about the park operations. We also decided, because we did not, quite frankly, get a lot of response from the mailer, about midsummer in August timeframe, we decided that let's just go out there in the park and see who's using it. And so we got about 85 response, actually more than that now, a few more came in, about 90 responses just going out there and talking to people that were using the park. So I'm going to give you some of the information from that. From the information we did gather, it's pretty equal split, local, meaning Chelan-Douglas County, and then other Washington states. So outside of Chelan-Douglas County, another third, and then we had about a third of the people attending the park were from out of state. The reason for their visit, we just quite frankly said, why did you stop at the park today? We had a majority of people saying, hey, I stopped to use the restroom, fix my boat trailer, or check on my lights, whatever it might be. We had about 28% using the boat launch, and then 10% using the day use, so swim area, maybe using one of the picnic benches, that kind of thing. We also looked at overall vehicle counts. So the way that's done in this case at that park is there's a rubber tubing that goes along, and so every time a car goes over, it counts how many cars are coming into the park. And we wanted to show you a comparison that with the camping, there was about 16,000 in 2017, 16,000 visitors. And again, these are just points in time data, so it's a little bit hard to say this is what's going to happen in the future. But 2018, with the removal of the camping and making this day use, we did see about half that number cut in half. So we believe that's mostly because that park was used for camping, and they really put a lot of people in that park. So, but now the day use we're seeing, especially with the boat launch, we're seeing local people being able to use their park once again. And that was some of the feedback we received from local community, is that they really appreciated having their park back, because with the camping, those parking lots were full. There wasn't room for a boat trailer. There wasn't room for the local people to come in and use it. They just put camping spread out throughout that park. So the sense we're getting is changing that back to day use and more of a local park, smaller park, seems to make a lot of sense and have really good benefit and value for local people. We also heard some of the comments coming back from people that used that park for camping, that we did have a majority of people say, hey, bring back camping, because we loved camping there. But we didn't find in our other parks that people were upset about that. In fact, we had very little comment at all about the fact that someone had been using a Rondo but were now using another park. We did have some groups that were able to take advantage of the group camping at Lincoln Rock or Daroga. So it was kind of, helpful for me to see that our other parks that can accommodate those types of uses, people are going there and using them. So short distance away, I think removing camping and making this more of a day use, boat launching, local park seems to make a lot of sense, and I think we're going to see the local area benefit from that.
Michelle, can I just ask a question? Certainly. While we're on the slide, do you know how our other parks rate with respect to residents' visits? Is the breakdown roughly the same, the 37, 32, 31 for in-state, out-of-state, local, not local?
That's a great question. It would depend on the park. So generally, any of our parks that have camping, we don't see a lot of local use. The numbers would be more in line with a smaller percentage. Any park that has camping obviously is going to get a lot more of outside of the area use. However, any kind of day use park, Chelan Falls is a good example, Powerhouse Park, Riverwalk Park, our numbers are a lot more local users. But if you would like to see the numbers, is Ryan here? Do we have those numbers, Ryan, that we can pull out for the commissioners? And we can bring it back later, too, if you don't have them at hand.
Good morning, commissioners. Ryan Baker, Parks Manager. Just to help answer this question, we do not track that specifically when we go out and do some of our use studies or we're interested in finding out additional information. We would ask some of those questions, but we do not track that on a regular basis.
Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
So looking forward, one of the things that we're proposing to do here is really just set up next year as another year similar to 2018. We'll continue, the port's planning to continue their discussion with the RCO office. What they're trying to do is reduce their facility obligations with the grant funding, because right now, the more that they've learned about that, they cannot, those are in perpetuity. So they can work towards what they call obsolescence. They can try and run them to their end of their life, useful life, and then ask RCO to take them off the books, per se. But what we know is that RCO has stated that they cannot remove the recreation obligation of that site. So even though the boat launch can go away or the docks can go away and they can claim obsolescence at the end of their useful life, the recreation commitment for making keeping that as a public site for access to the Columbia River cannot go away. So those are the kinds of things they're trying to do, is maybe remove some of those restrictions so at least the changes or the future operation of that park, there's a lot more flexibility and they're not tied specifically to the facilities that have been funded by grants.
So, may I jump in here, Michelle? So that makes me a little nervous when I hear you say they're looking at run this into obsolescence. How does that impact what we want to do, what we're considering mm-hmm. doing? Just the sound of running it into obsolescence, and then at that point, then we pick it up and try to bring it back up. That's not really... This can be done in a parallel fashion and not affect the quality and the upkeep and so forth, right?
Yes. Thank you for that question. That's a great segue into what I wanted to talk about next, really, was we are thinking that, and we being the port and the PUD staff, as we've been trying to figure out what makes sense for the future of this park to benefit both of us, And one of the ideas we have is if you look at other parks along, well, recreation areas, I won't even call them parks, but I'm including these grant PUD areas as an example, where it is okay to have an access point to the river without making it a park like the PUD thinks of our parks, right? So we have very... expensive, you know, we keep our parks green. We have very high standards for our parks. And as we look at the future, I think we want to realize that we don't have to have that at every site that we have in our recreation plan. So what we're actually talking about doing is keeping this more low-key, keeping it maybe even a year-round boating access at this site, which is very limited along the Douglas County side of the river during the winter especially, and really minimizing then and keeping this a low-cost future obligation for the port, and then also if the PUD, depending on what that business model looks like, we will get down to how the PUD would support that into the future and whether or not the PUD even wants to continue to have this particular site in our mix of park obligations. So we haven't quite gotten to that point yet. I think what we'd rather do is wait for the planning process to evolve and let the port build a business case and a business plan for this and then see where that ends up. But the next step is really to try and get our arms around a couple of conceptual designs, some options, helping the port with that next year. And then kind of going out, if you will, similar to Coyote Dunes, where we took those concepts out, let the public weigh in on those designs, and then make a final decision and then let the port put a business plan together for that, together with their RCO, future obligation outlook, and then have something to come back to the PUD and see where we can support it at that time.
Okay.
So, Michelle, just a question. I'm not familiar with the Grant PUD, Rattlesnake Cove, or the Buckshot Recreation Area, which are referred to as passive. Do they have bathroom facilities, or is a passive area not requiring a bathroom facility, or?
Yeah, so the definition of passive is just that it has, it's more almost like a stopover or just a put-in place. So it's not as developed out as you would call a normal park like we think of it. So in this case, they do have either a single or a double vault toilet there that are very, like you'd see it almost at a rest stop or something, you know, much, it's almost like what you see that we're going to put at Coyote Dunes. So you basically come in, you spray them down, and, you know, it's very low maintenance. So what we're hoping is that maybe we can even go towards that and therefore keep the boat trailer parking. We're not sure if keeping the lawn makes sense. It seems that, you know, going more towards some natural shrub step might make some more sense there. But all of that takes transition and some time. But we think that park lends itself to that. Lisa Parks at the port also mentioned that she's going to be talking to the Department of Transportation, because what we realize is there is not a rest stop, quite frankly, in any of the vicinity from Wenatchee on up north. So, you know, maybe there's even some help from the DOT that can come into play here in terms of using this more as a passive kind of a stopping location for transportation.
These Grant PUD ones, is one of those located right just below Interstate 90 as you head down to Wampum Dam?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
Near the Renita Bridge.
Yeah, just no, it's near the Interstate 90 bridge.
Right.
Yes.
That's what I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You're exactly right.
Got yeah. Wrong.
That's a great example of one that you may have seen the sign or been down there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Other thoughts? I did want to say that I unpacked all of the detailed survey information for you as an appendix, so you're welcome to look at the actual details. And then I also summarized the legal obligations related to our license and then the RCO obligations for the port as well. So just as a reminder.
That survey you took, you know, and maybe no data was kept prior to this as to where people, the park users, were coming from for this year. Could you get a sense that... The one sense you got, it was pretty dramatic change. The locals felt like they were getting their park back.
Yes, it's a huge change, because anytime you take away camping, you're going to get a different park user. And what we're finding is, you know, that we are seeing a lot of local people that are telling us that they appreciate, and I just put it, this is the word, that they're getting their park back. And that park was built as a day-use park for the local community originally, and camping was added later to generate revenue. So I think, you know, the public perception is, boy, we hate to see the camping go away, but we believe our other parks can make up for that. And then we have the local folks that are saying, hey, we appreciate being able to take our boat down there and be able to park our trailer as we, you know, use the river.
So. Maybe the local folks want to create a park district.
Well, it's a possibility. I don't think we're taking anything off the table for the future.
I just want to say thank you for all the work you've done on this, and for your focus on the local people. As you said, that's what it was intended for, and I do under, well, I attended the meeting that we had at the Arondo School and listened to some of the local people, and they really did feel like their park had been hijacked.
Yeah.
I mean, they did use that word. So thank you for all your work on this. And, I felt all along, we've got fabulous camping parks 10 miles away and 15 miles away, one to the north, one to the south. So that definitely helps steer our decision-making here. And then the other thing is, I really like the idea of a natural, I said it before, but, you know, a more natural recreation area. We could still have a nice bathroom facility. but not have all the green grass that has to be mowed and irrigated and have a more natural setting and have some, maybe even if we wanted to, have some kiosks with some, you know, some information about the natural species and the shrub step. And so I love where you're going with it. And thanks for all the, I mean, you looked at every option, every possibility. Thanks.
Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you.
Commissioners, anything else? Michelle, thank you very much. I guess where this commissioner is coming from, I just think we need to keep moving and moving forward. This isn't being addressed to us, but if we need homework done so we can complete the project, I'd like to see that get done. Quarterly board report.
So this one is actually yours, and I'm realizing that Deborah is not here, and so I'll just jump in and say there really is no change since the last quarter. You had one item that was challenged earlier in the year in terms of Energy Northwest board participation, just due to illness. And other than that, as far as I know, the board is on track with all of its commitments for this year.
And I will be there on the 25th.
So may I just make it? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Just a comment and kind of directed at Steve or maybe all of you. So I look at this, and my first look, I'm the first S1 Sustainer Public Partnership. And that's at the top of our balanced scorecard because we felt that that deserved or needed to have the most focus. And so I looked at that, and my first thought was, well, yeah, we're fine. We're on target for everything. But then I'm just asking myself, are we looking at this broadly enough? When we talk about sustaining our public partnership, is considering tri-commission meetings and mid-sea commission meetings, is that enough? I mean, should we look more broadly at, say, for example, public power, large public power council? Well, you're affiliated with that. But are we doing enough here? I don't know. I'm just tossing that out. Steve, I'd like you to consider that because you're out and about a lot, you know, dealing with other publics, and could we get a better feel and look at this? And the other question I have is, should it be combined with Commissioner McKenna's responsible board representation indicator? Because they do overlap. So we don't need to have a discussion today. I'm just throwing that out there maybe to think about, and next time we talk about this, we could spend a little bit of time, and Steve, maybe you could help us with, is there a way to broaden and look better at our sustaining our public partnership if we're missing something?
Might that be a good topic to do at our next board workshop?
Mm-hmm. I don't mean to add on a lot of work and take a lot of time, but it just seems like that might be too limited.
Yeah, we can capture that.
Thank you. Yeah, and there is a meeting on the 24th, 25th at Energy Northwest, and I will be there.
Yeah, I'd be happy to give a little bit of thought to that, although I do want to say generally we don't put a lot of thought into this because this one is the board's balance scorecard. So it'd be more of a, here's some information for you to consider.
Yeah,
but
that's what I'm looking for.
It's your choices as to where you want to go with it.
But if you could give us some things to look at and to consider, that would be helpful, okay. I think.
So you think, yeah. Okay.
So let me make sure I've got that right, that Teresa, I have that right. So the first is the question of public partnership, whether there should be some additional items that are considered that extend beyond the county borders, in effect, to think about other ways that we partner with particularly public power. And then I heard a proposal to meld the stakeholder with another one, but I'm sorry I missed that. So I wanted to come back and just, what were the two that you were thinking about melding?
Public partnership and responsible board representation, because there is some overlap.
Okay.
And that would probably be something for us, for just for the board to decide.
Yep.
Yep.
Got it.
Finishing my notes. All right. Do we want to pick up any items in the next 12 minutes?
So we have one manager item that I want to keep for this afternoon because we've got some folks coming in to talk about it. I just got a couple of things I'd like to put on your screen as updates. First of all, there is going to be an energy environment field hearing October 29th in Wenatchee, kind of a broad. They're walking around the state talking to different people, tell us what's on your mind kind of hearing as far as we can tell at this point. So we're thinking about the types of issues that we want to have engaged there. They're sort of giving different interest groups short opportunities to provide information. So we're trying to pick our highest priorities and get that in front of them.
Who's doing that, Steve?
I forget the names of the folks. So it's the state legislature, the Environment and Energy Committee in the Senate.
Okay.
The crypto rate, just want to make sure that you're aware we continue to move ahead in terms of developing the specifics around that. We will present at the next board meeting the material that we plan to present at the public meeting. That's really meant to be the deep dive for staff and anybody that wants to come in and talk about technical issues with us. But you will see that first before it goes out into the public meeting. The project south of town that's at the old Blodgett property that is sometimes known as Ant Creek, sometimes known as Aspen, we continue to have discussions with them. They believe that they are going to be an equipment repair facility for cryptocurrency machines, that they will not be actually mining for cryptocurrency. So we had more conversation with them last week. That continues to move along. Based on the conversation last week, I'm reasonably optimistic that we're going to be able to come to agreement about a package of things that, first of all, is commitments that they would make to not cryptocurrency mine, and some thoughts that we have about pricing for this kind of unique operation. And then finally, just want to put on your screen that there's a lot of fallout from the California legislature choosing to not proceed with the regionalization legislation for the California Independent System Operator. And we continue to get a lot of requests for what is your view on this. I'm being quite clear on this, that there may well be a need for markets as you operate with a lot of variable energy resources that are non-dispatchable in the West, going to real-time operations that spreads across a larger footprint just fundamentally makes sense. And that both because of the reliability implications, also for the economic opportunities that occur with that in terms of efficiency. But having an operation that is run by one state, where the leadership is picked by one state, is unacceptable to us. We do not see a way that you could ever get commitments up front. And there are lots of ways that this is described, that there would be commitments, that the governance somehow, there would be commitments, it would be independent, yet ultimately it still reports to this CAISO board. So I don't see how you can ultimately ever get to that point of fixing the problem, that the market structures, there'll be commitments, but again, the board will be able to change those later in time, that there will be no-cost exit strategies. If you don't like it, you can get out. But the problem is you will have sunk a bunch of money to get into it. And once markets are formed, it's difficult to dissolve them. So just wanted you to be aware we're taking a very strong position that seems hard for us to understand how that can be good for the Northwest.
Are we joined by others?
Yes.
In that position, I would think.
We have worked very closely with the public generating pool in particular. To develop these thoughts. We've been having conversations for a long time, a couple of years, but intensely for the last couple of months about this.
Are all of the Mid-Seas part of the PGP?
Douglas is not.
Okay.
Grant is.
Okay.
Jokingly, kind of along the not good for necessarily one state to operate on its own. I just started reading a book called, 21 Problems for the 21st Century. And the guy was jokingly saying that, you know, we're interested to a certain extent on a wall between the United States and Mexico, not thinking about a firewall between California and the rest of the nation. So it's still there. So with that being said.
Quick question about California. We got a couple minutes. The legislation that was signed into law the last couple of weeks ago requiring carbon-free generation by 2050, I think that was, what's the likelihood of impact on our hydro with that legislation the way it's written?
So it's a 60% renewable portfolio standard that does not include hydro. And then for the remaining 40%, they want a commitment to carbon-free energy by 2045.
Okay.
We're fairly active there in trying to make sure that hydro was not excluded from the last 40%. We believe the language does not exclude it. But I will say that there is an ongoing effort in California right now on the part of some parties to exclude hydro through the California PUC processes in particular, based on the argument that there is what's called resource shuffling, that utilities are taking their hydro, selling it to California, and then using brown power to serve their local loads. We are not doing that, clearly not doing that. We're accounting for that to make sure that we're not doing that. So there is a need for a very important ongoing conversation there to make sure that hydro, and particularly Northwest large hydro, is not excluded from the California marketplace.
So we don't have real clarity on whether there's going to be an opportunity yet.
Well, the opportunity remains today for the types of sales that we have been making. I think we view it more of a risk that those current opportunities will be curtailed in some way. Okay. And the problem is that just an ongoing debate. It probably never goes away.
Yeah.
So. Thoughts? Let's recess for this. Return at 1 o'clock for our regular business meeting. We'll go ahead then. Good afternoon. This is Chelan County Board of Commissioners coming into our afternoon session, our business session, October 15th, 2018. All five commissioners are here. We have a quorum, and we'll be starting with our consent agenda. Commissioners, what is your desire in terms of dealing with the consent agenda?
Move to approve the consent agenda.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda as presented. Is there discussion? Hearing none, those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried. You're waving?
I'm waving.
Was that a yes wave?
That was a yes wave.
Okay. Just wanted to check so that that can get recorded. Regular agenda, item 12, please.
A resolution declaring Biomark Incorporated of Boise, Idaho as the sole source supplier of passive integrated transponder tags and associated equipment, including antenna arrays for evaluation of the district's hatchery programs operated as part of the Habitat Conservation Plan. Authorizing the waiver of bidding requirements and authorizing the district's general manager to enter into a contract with Biomark Incorporated. We have both Jen Sagasser and Lance Keller here to talk about this. I'll turn it over to them.
Good afternoon. Thank you. I'm John Sagasser, engineering manager at Rock Island, and we are presenting a resolution declaring Biomark of Boise, Idaho as the sole source provider for pit tag and associated equipment. Biomark has been the sole source provider for pit tags, antennas, and associated equipment for us for over a decade now and are used along most of the Columbia River. They have a proprietary frequency and technology that they use in their pit tags and in their antennas that is common to all the hydros along the Columbia River. If approved, we would be using this latest sole source authorization to execute a contract not to exceed $250,000 for the design, fabrication, and installation of a new pit tag antenna array at the right adult fish ladder down at Rock Island. The right ladder at Rock Island is the primary migration path for adult salmon, and as such, the accurate detection and detection efficiency of the pit tag system is of this ladder is vital to our HCP goals. We use the antennas to calculate the adult passage rate past Rock Island. We also use it to help supplement our hatchery production numbers, so it's very important. We installed an antenna down at Rock Island in this right fish ladder back in 2006. However, we had electromagnetic interference problems generated from the powerhouse, namely the variable frequency drives associated with the cooling fans in the generator. So the detection efficiency has been poor there since the onset. The antenna was replaced in 2015 with a redesigned antenna with some improved shielding and grounding techniques to help minimize the impacts of the electromagnetic interference, but it's still not to where we would want it to be. We've actually seen a rapid decline in the detection efficiency, especially since June of 2018, so fairly recently, to where we're at the 30 to 40% rate. So we're only detecting, you know, not even half of the fish that are going through that particular ladder at this point in time. So therefore, again, if approved, this contract would install a new antenna array. We would do a couple of things differently this time to make sure that this new antenna was successful. One of the first things that we're doing is that we would locate it as far downstream in the fish ladder as we could, try to get away from the source of the noise, which is the powerhouse. We're also doing some electromagnetic interference testing to make sure that we install it in a location where the noise is the least, and then also so we would know the exact frequency of the noise so that they can design the shielding, grounding, and capacitive filters that can actually filter out that noise as best as possible. The last thing we would do is we're actually going to use some of that same information to rebuild the existing antenna so it would get some modified filters and shielding in place, and we would tie those together so that we would have two functional locations to help improve the overall detection efficiency of that ladder. So the new ladders, we'd do all this testing and design work through this fall and into the winter, and the new antenna would be installed in February of 2019 as part of a planned fish overhaul. Questions?
No, that's just interesting. So why do you think you're getting, you know, less and less? Why is it decreasing? Or actually, why is the interference increasing, or the effectiveness of the tag is going down at a fairly fast rate? I mean, why would that be? And when did you first detect this? I mean, when did you figure out that these weren't as effective as they should be?
Well, so we figured out, we got them as effective as we could when we installed the new antenna in 2015. I don't have the exact detection rate at that point in time.
Was the idea there to put in a new antenna and hopefully get better yep. detection rates?
Yep, that was the idea. Redesigned antenna, get improved detection rates. We had some additional information, again, on the source of the noise. We're still analyzing some of the data to understand why this one would decrease at such a rapid mm-hmm. rate, but it indicates that we either have some problems in our shielding or our ground methodology. Could be the design of the antenna. contract with Biomark for maintenance and support services, so they're constantly analyzing the system and the data, trying to understand it as well.
That's so important because we have to account for those fish.
We do have to account
for
the
critical
fish.
For us. So I'm grateful. That's so great. You guys are really delving into it.
Thank you.
So you're thinking that you'll potentially be able to use two antenna now to increase your accuracy. Does that mean that all of these pit tags have individual signals, so you know the individual fish as it goes through? Because if it's going through two different antennas, how do you separate them?
Commissioner Smith, you're correct. They are individual tag codes. It's a 13 character long code that's made up of numbers and letters. And essentially, when that fish is implanted with that tag, wherever it is in its lifespan, its current life state, whether it's a juvenile or adult, it is given that number for the duration of the rest of its life. So those are individual tags, and the antenna arrays, as well as having additional arrays, allow for those individual tag codes to be collected when there's numerous tags in the immediate detection field.
And about how many of those a year do you use?
We come to the board every year for about 70,000 for our Fish and Wildlife program, and roughly, I'd say 95%+ of those are for our anadromous program for salmon and steelhead. Hmm. Okay.
Wow. It's a lot of tracking.
Yes.
We get credit for it.
Yeah. Well, okay, good.
So Biomark, so that's quite an investment. And Biomark will be working with you regarding efficiency and staying on to make sure that it's working.
Yes, absolutely. As I mentioned previously, we already have a kind of an annual maintenance agreement with Biomark for exactly that, the kind of the tuning, the testing, making sure our pit tag detection systems are operating as they should. And that will continue with the new antenna as well.
Thank you.
So I'm going to take just a second, a human adaptation, a pit tag, to measure blood sugar. You no longer have to stab yourself in the finger. There it is. Hmm. And it's an implant, individual recording of each implant that you have put in, tracks your blood sugar for you, charts it, lays it out, and I'm feeling a much more oneness with our salmon. It's really cool, but if you know somebody who's dealing with diabetic, and asked to do that measurement and wants to get away from it.
You could be the first commissioner we track through the juvenile fish bite.
If I walk by that array and a different number shows up, it's like, oh, the commissioner's out someplace he shouldn't be.
Tubing down the fish ladder.
There we go, yeah. Thanks for that indulgence, but it's really funny. When I was getting this thing, I'm thinking, dang fish. Yeah. They've been ahead of us for a long time. Yeah. But that's really cool. But anyway, yeah, it's a wonderful tool. So thank you, gentlemen. Yep. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Nothing else, I assume? Okay. And to the audience and those listening, thanks for your indulgence. We got the Huskies. We've got the Ducks. And we've got the Tag today. Number 13.
Resolution approving a new interlocal cooperative purchasing agreement, SA number 18-126, between the District and Energy Northwest for the purchase of materials, equipment, and supplies.
Mark Ripley. Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Mark Ripley, manager with the PCS Department. The item that we're bringing before you today is to request that the general manager have authority to go ahead and enter into this agreement. If it sounds slightly familiar, we had this agreement once before. We have a wish to continue the agreement with Energy Northwest. There are several other utility districts that are also involved with this procurement. The first one we are going to be doing is for underground conductor cable. And so we're building the framework for us to go ahead and work on these procurements that are more focused on our industry. The hope is, after the program is finished and we do have a successful solicitation, is to go ahead and have individual utility districts take the lead role in specific procurements that other districts can go ahead and piggyback. So this is the first one of many.
Very good.
And one thing I was going to say I forgot to mention is there is no commitment for us to procure on this just yet. Hopefully, as soon as we get this resolution approved, we're going to be releasing the first advertisements. Very sure. Any questions? No?
I think we're good.
Well, thanks. You made it easy.
Actually, you made it easy.
Yeah. Oh.
Because you were thorough.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm not asking for money yet.
That's
true. In the next month, that'll be different.
There we go. 14.
This is a resolution authorizing the general manager to purchase a 40-acre parcel of land in Douglas County from James F. Kern, successor trustee of the Kern Revocable Trust, on which the district developed and operates the Ski Badger Communication Site, and approving a capital budget revision for acquisition of this property. So Mike Coleman's going to join Lisa Graves here so that Mike can talk a little bit, start off about the importance of this site to us.
Correct. You're going to put up the slide?
I am.
Okay, I'm going to start by saying that when this opportunity came up and we became aware that the Kern family was looking at selling the site, we took a number of looks at it to examine our options, and a lot of it is what if. But we came to the conclusion that this site is a critical to the district. We have both our microwave node up there as well as a trunk radio, land mobile radio node, and other circuits from the district. And if you look at the terrain that it occupies, which is a high point on the east side of the river, it covers the entire Chelan Gorge from Wenatchee up to Chelan. So this site gives us visibility, allows us to operate the trunk radio network through the entire gorge. And the trunk radio network is, of course, one of our critical systems that we're replacing right now with a digital mobile radio. And that is a safety tool for the entire district when they're out in those areas. The other thing that we looked at is on the what if side is, what if somebody else buys this property? Are they buying it as an investment? Are they buying it for other purposes? What if we have to move? What is the criticality and the cost to the district under those circumstances? At the end of that analysis, we did determine that it is a site that is critical now. It's expected to be critical into the future as far as 10, 20, 30 years. We also know that the site is critical to many of the other telecom companies that operate in that area, simply because of the coverage that it affords and the particular terrain that it's covering. So with that, I'll let Lisa go into the resolution.
Okay, so Mike has shared a little bit why this property is important to us. And I just wanted to give you a little more background. And the district has been at this site since 1995, initially be co-located onto another party's site. And then in 1996, we entered into our own separate individual lease, proceeded then to build our own site, which consists of a control building and tower. So we've been there since then. Mike has shared that this is going to continue to be an important site to us. The owner is at a point where he wants to sell this property. He's actively decided he's not going to keep it any longer. And the district has a right of first refusal on the property. There are a total of 5 tenants on the property, including the district. The current lease that the district has runs through 2026. In September of 2017, we had an appraisal done on the property. And since then, the district and property owner have agreed to a purchase price of $460,000. We've entered into an agreement contingent on board approval. At this purchase price, the district would recover its investment in 15 years. This acquisition makes sense to the district because the site's integral to our radio system. Acquiring the property means the district will control its cost to continue operating the site, and we'll recover that investment in a matter of about 15 years. Do you have any questions?
Can we just, for the audience, public, specify how that payback is done, how that investment is paid back in 15 years?
Well, the district itself is currently paying an annual rent of about $5,500. It will increase in another 3 years. We have an adjustment every 5 years. And the rent from the other tenants up there is currently a little over $32,000. So. Any other questions? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much.
How about we take that individually? Should we take that and vote on it?
Yeah, we can do all three together, or we can do them separate, or whatever is the desire of the commission.
All three is fine.
Okay. Doesn't matter to me. I just thought this was important and timely.
More important than the pit tag?
I think so.
So, Commissioner Congdon, if you would like to make a move on item 14.
Yes.
We'll do the other two.
I move adoption of resolution number 13, approving a new interlocal cooperative. Wrong one. Where is it?
14.
14, yeah, I'm sorry. Authorizing the general manager to purchase a 40-acre parcel of land in Douglas County from James F. Kern, successor trustee of the Kern Revocable Trust on which the district developed and operates the Ski Badger Communications site, and approving a capital budget revision for acquisition of this property.
Second.
Been moved and seconded to adopt Resolution 14 as presented. Is there further discussion? Hearing none, those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is unanimous. Items 12 and 13.
I would move adoption of items 12 and 13 as presented.
Second.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to adopt resolutions 12 and 13 as presented. Is there further discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor of 12 and 13 as presented, please signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Sometime in the future, it would be nice to hear back how that upgraded on the antenna is working. I'd like to hear back on that someday.
Probably after manager.
Okay. We will continue with manager items. We had a couple this morning, and I believe that there's at least one additional.
Yeah, I want to invite Dan Garrison for Cutson to come up and talk about a couple of things that are going on at our hydro project.
Good afternoon. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. With me is Dan Garrison, Director of Hydro. And we've got a couple of updates, one for Rocky Reach and one for Lake Chelan. With that, I'll turn it over to Dan to talk about Rocky Reach.
So in case you haven't heard, on Unit 1 at Rocky Reach, we had an oil spill, oil release in the Columbia River starting in last January. We have been researching and trying to find ways to repair that leak without total disassembly of the unit. And we had tried purchasing some special oil seals, and we put them into service a little while ago. I don't remember the exact date. I'm sorry about that. Near the end of October. Excuse me, end of September. And we had shortly had a small sheen in the river. So we removed the unit from service immediately and have begun researching the cause of this. So our underlying assumption, having seen the scene, is that these special new seals that were slated for this did not perform as we intended. So our assumption now is to go into complete disassembly of Unit 1, bring the turbine up onto the floor, continue disassembly, and replace the trunnion bushings. They have worn. We know they've been worn. That is essentially the root cause of the leaks, but we are hoping to avoid a replacement at this time. But we'll go in and continue with that effort very shortly. The oil leak has not been quantified yet with the DOE. I just got some news this morning, though, that we have drained about 2 gallons of water off the bottom of the turbine hub, which is indicative of, yeah, there's water going into the hub, a small amount, but some was getting in there. That doesn't mean we've only lost 2 gallons of oil, but it's an indicator that we've lost at least 2 gallons of oil. We will continue the rest of this week to drain the oil out of the turbine hub and verify how much oil is in there. So I'm comfortable in reporting to you that we have displaced at least 2 gallons, hopefully no more, but I won't know that for sure until the end of this week. So this is a recent development. It causes a lot of changes for us to do on our outage planning. What we have up on the screen here is the best way that I can think of to describe to you what's changing. So the top part is the outages at Rocky Reach in response to C1. And then you see on the bottom the thing that says previous plan. That's what it looked like about 2 weeks ago. So we had them planned. Let's see if my mouse is my mouse showing up there.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Unit 1 should have completed its outage early in October. We should have been generating, and then we'd go into our other maintenance and projects accordingly. We have experienced this problem. So what we're going to do is leave Unit 1 out of service. We will continue with this outage here, C3, as previously planned, for a couple of reasons, but the most important one is we need time to plan this whole unit outage out for Unit 1. So we'll spend the next 3 weeks with our engineering and our planning staff to identify the scope of work, all the procedures necessary to dismantle this unit, make sure everything is up to our standards. So after C3, this is just a small overhaul. There are some things we need to take care of. When that work is complete, we will begin the disassembly of Unit 1 in earnest, and we are estimating at this time about 6 months to complete that work. So by mid-May, we will have replaced those trunnion bushings, and we'll be back in business. There is some domino effect with outages. We had planned on taking Unit 4 out in mid-January to do governor replacement work. That's going to have to be deferred until Unit 1 is back in service. So we're going to defer that work about 6 months. Any questions so far? Okay.
If the issue is in one, is it in two?
Most three, likely, yeah. So
four?
Yeah, through seven.
Through seven.
Through seven. So, you know, these bushings are in a neighborhood of 20 years old.
Yep.
And they do wear. We know they've been wearing. Unit one is the first one to present a active problem for us.
Okay.
In fact, Kirk was quizzing me before this meeting. We had planned on replacing those trunnion seals out starting in, trunnion bushings starting in 2021. That's still our plan. But as we disassemble Unit 1, we will be looking for what are the trigger mechanisms that we can identify that says it's time to do this on 2 through 7. So we're going to stick with Plan A for 2 through 7 this time, but it is quite possible that we will identify something that says we need to accelerate that schedule. Okay?
The other piece I might add is that just like we did the holistic design review on units 8 through 11, we're doing the same thing on 1 through 7. And so part of that is to give us some insight into are there other things we might encounter as we begin to pull this unit apart that we should be looking specifically at. Part of that analysis is already done, but there's still another analysis to take place that'll help us determine how far we go into this unit. But this will be the first one that will inform us on what has to be done to the other units and when. No shortage of challenges.
Yeah. I just want to give Kirk and Dan credit. When the problem showed up with the seal, the question was, can we put in the places fixed? Will it work? And certainly the idea was, let's try to do this without the big outage. But in case the bad thing happened, they began procurement for the bushing, and they also began looking at the question of, if we are pulling this thing out, let's begin to understand now, way back a few months ago, what kinds of issues we should be looking for as we're opening this thing up. So some good planning work has been done, but just in case we found ourselves in this situation, and put us on a few steps ahead of where we would have been otherwise.
Yeah. As Steve said, those replacement bushings were ordered several months ago. They are in their final stages of fabrication now, and we're expecting shipment within a week or two. So certainly by the time we have this unit disassembled, we'll have the materials in place, and that won't be a slowdown for us.
Excuse me, Gary. A question. Is a trunnion bushing something that a sensor technology could perhaps monitor and detect in the future? Is that part of perhaps hydro research looking at that particular element?
Yeah, go ahead.
Dan's interested in knowing that.
You can.
Not sure we can instrument the trunnion, the bushing itself, but there are other things we think we'll be able to instrument that might detect something that's an anomaly or a change that you can't see unless you pull the unit out and take measurements. So that's what we'd be looking at, is can we instrument some other part of the turbine to where we'd see a change.
Okay, great.
Very difficult to do the bushing itself.
Sure.
In place, but that's the kind of stuff we'd be looking at.
Great.
Yeah.
Good.
And the jury's still out on some of the things, even some of the measurements we take. You get some people saying, yeah, that indicates wear, and other people saying, no, that's really not indicative of wear. So those are the challenges we'll have with a lot of sensors, determining which ones really tell us something that we have to take action on.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. The next update is Lake Chelan.
Chelan. As of last Friday, Unit A2 was recommissioned and put back into service. It ran successfully all weekend long and is still continuing to run without incident. So that's great news. That was a very important milestone for us for a couple of reasons. The two big reasons were to support system stability, but as Douglas County has some transmission work that they need to do. And the other is to support the fish spawning in the tail race channel. So we needed that unit back for different reasons, but we still needed that unit back, and we're happy to report that that's there. Unit A1 is in its final stages of commissioning right now, and all of the issues that we saw in A2 also applied to A1. We took care of them at that time, so I expect that the majority of the problems we had with A2 have been rectified, and by the end of this week, A2 or A1 should be back into service.
Excellent.
you might recall, this is there was a tremendous amount of work done and associated with that outage up there with the surge tank, replacing the circuit breakers, the work on the turbines themselves, and the outreach effort we did earlier this year to let customers know up there we were in a not a normal configuration, concerns about fires, and we had a number of fires this summer underneath both the transmission lines we were worried about. But boy, to commend Dan and his team in engineering and project management and all the work that got done, the outreach efforts, the planning that went into that, this was a major milestone to get that back up and running. And hopefully we won't go through another summer with an outage like that, worried about all those issues we're worried about. Quite a few months there.
And two things. Number one, grateful that we didn't have a fire, you know, that would really impact it while these were being commissioned. And then the second thought I have is, how grateful are we that we are sitting in such a strong financial position and have cash with the continuing issues that you guys are facing at the hydro projects. Must be a relief for you, for all of us, but definitely for you to know that financially we're solid and can deal with these things as they come along.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I remember when we were $1 billion in debt.
We weren't.
It was one of the first meetings that Randy and I attended. A couple of engineers came in and said, turbines at Lake Chelan are starting to wobble. Not exactly a scientific or engineering term, but we got it. And we need to borrow $60 million. And we just campaigned on reducing debt.
Yeah.
So you're like, so much better position. And thanks for pointing that out, Ann.
The other thing that's
appreciate
very,
the work.
Yeah, thank you. The other thing that's very comforting is what's on the wall back here. Best for the most for the longest. When you get into situations like C1, where, okay, this is outside of the plan, it sure helps us in operations make decisions with that in mind, that that's what we're after, because the tendency is to, let's get this thing back up online.
Short term.
But this allows us to look at it thoroughly and really plan for what's the best way to do this, knowing that's the objective.
Yeah, we don't need Band-Aids on something like that.
Yeah, these are supposed to last, you know, 30, 40 years, and so that's our objective, is to get this back up and tip-top shape to run for a long time.
We're an aging infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, we're going to have some expenses. Off we go. So, but good people, good work. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. That's all the manager items that we have.
Okay. On commissioner items, I have one. And it's the motion to set a special meeting. And commissioners, would you take a look at that? And let's decide what it is we want to do.
Mr. Chairman, I move to set a special meeting November 5th, 2018 at 9:30 a.m. at the Commissioner's Boardroom, 327 North Wenatchee Avenue, Wenatchee, for the purpose of viewing software demo.
Is there a second?
Second.
Been moved and seconded to set a special meeting November 5th, 2018 at 9:30 at the Commission Board Room, 327 North Wenatchee Avenue, Wenatchee, for the purpose of viewing a software demo. Discussion? Hearing none. Those in favor of the motion as presented signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion is carried.
Will there be popcorn?
I don't know.
Ask Kelly.
Well, from this morning, I believe it's already roasted. We could move on. Other commission items, please.
Quickly. Just a huge thank you to Debbie Gallagher and Casey, and I can't remember Casey's last name now, but took Commissioner McKenna and myself on a tour of the visitor center. They don't call it visitor, Heritage Center, I think. Anyway, at Wanapum Dam, and then on down to Priest Rapids Dam. And the idea was to take a look at what they've done. Both are new. Both are quite new, and both are quite beautiful, unbelievable. They're fascinating. But the idea at the first one at Wanapum Dam was to see what the potential is, what you can do in a small space, because our space at Rocky Reach Visitor Center is going to be maybe twice what they had there. I can't remember exactly, but we'll have quite a bit more space. But it's a bit of a small space there at Wanapum Dam, and they did absolutely amazing things with it. I walked in and looked around and said, Chuck Hall was our tour guide, and they, or not Hall, Chuck, anyway, James, no. Anyway, my thought was, well, can we just copy what you guys did? Because it is just, it's terrific. It's there's so much in a small space, but you know, you don't feel like you're on top of each other, and it's mostly all interactive. You're not going to get kids to read things off the wall. It's touching, pushing buttons, riding a bike, looking at the lights. There's a big control center that they can manually, you know, interact with, and it's fabulous. If you have not gone to see it, I recommend that you do that. And for Pete's sake, take your grandkids, because they will love it. It's really neat. And it'll give all of us an idea of what the potential is, what we could do out there. And then go down the road to Priest Rapids Dam, and that's a, they call it the people's, anyway, it is the whole facility is a $20 million facility, and it is a huge, beautiful exhibit of the Wanapum tribes. And their land and their water, and it's somewhat interactive as well, but just so beautifully done. It's so worth the trip. And I think they're 10 miles apart, maybe 15 miles apart is all. Take your lunch. There's no place to stop and buy lunch. It's well worth the trip.
There's a mini mart at Desert Air.
There is. So you could get cheese and crackers. But it was so worth the trip, and I'm sure Steve has a comment as well.
Well, just... Also, on the side note, that was an exceptional trip, and I won't add anything more to it, but the really great kudos to the team working on the Discovery Center on the combination of facility and the interactive nature of the Discovery Center. It was just such a great feeling with all the people there working on moving that forward, with the architect and people from the video production side of things. And it was just an extremely good start. So very exciting. Mm-hmm. And what I appreciated about the tour and with Chuck is that not only did we see what they've done well, but we've learned from them on what they would do differently the next time, and as they get ready to update what they're going to be updating and what that would be updated to. So we learned a lot, and which really gives me a lot of excitement for what's possible at our Discovery Center. So cool things going on.
Very good. Nice report. Randy.
Yeah, just to let everybody know that this week I'll be going over to Olympia for the PUD Association Budget Committee meeting, and I think everybody here except Steve has had that opportunity to participate in the Budget Committee in past years. Have you, Gary?
Yes.
And so, Steve, there's a magical formula that we go by in the PUD Association that protects all parties to at least some degree. The formula for who pays dues is established by your retail revenue and your number of customers, and there's a cap set for the large utilities, and we're not quite at that cap yet. There's I think five of them at that cap. So anyway, I'm very conscious of that as I go, that we want to make sure that we don't mess with the formula. We aren't going to raise dues a whole lot. We just want to have a good functioning association, and I'll go there with that in mind and our utility in mind.
Yeah, I would just add that formula has come with great consternation. That was not easy to arrive at, and it seems to be working generally.
Yeah.
For most people.
I think that's a great way to say it.
Yeah, small utilities sometimes feel like they're paying too much.
Yeah, Steve?
I just had one other item. Attended the port breakfast, which our manager was one of the panelists, and I just really wanted to say how informative that day was, not only to hear how about the economic development in the valley, but really a feeling for how important it is for different agencies to be working together to make things happen for the betterment of our county. And also compliments to Steve. It was just well presented, very informative, and great morning. So I appreciated being there.
I want to tag on that one because I also was at that breakfast, and there was a comment that Steve made in his presentation, or maybe during the question and answer, that I think the entire county should hear, and it probably didn't make the paper. And that's the one where he said, you know, he's lived in a lot of different areas in his career, and never in his life has he experienced the sense of community that he has experienced when he got to Wenatchee, the greater Wenatchee area. And that's a real, you know, kudos for us from a person who's been around a lot of areas and seen a lot of activities. I want to personally thank you for that observation because it gives me a little sense of pride, or maybe a big sense of pride. So thank you.
Very well. Any other commissioner items? Item 17, follow-up on delegation of action items from previous meetings.
So we just have one, and it's in motion. So really not much to report. That was the question about addressing Mr. Martini's concerns about what the impact would be on his location. So Eric's doing some work on that with our staff. So nothing to report today other than just that we're working on it and we get back to you in the future.
Okay. Delegation of action item.
The one that we've got is the one that Commissioner Congdon requested, which is that we get on the next board workshop the review of the board's balance scorecard with respect to scope of public partnerships beyond county borders, and then thinking about that relative to the responsible board presentation actions that are there.
Okay. 19, additional public comment. Members of the public are encouraged, and I don't believe we have any members of the general public. So we will then any other items to come before the commission? Okay, number 21. And Eric has shortened this for me, so maybe we can do this with a little bit more diplom. Executive session to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district force board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risk as authorized by RCW 42.30.1101I. So time and
30 minutes.
So we just head into it. Okay, so it's approximately 10 minutes to 2. So we were looking for about a 2:20 exit. This is Chelan County Board of Directors coming back into session following our executive session where no votes were taken, no decisions were made. And if there's no other further business to come before our meeting today, we're adjourned at 2:22. Thank you very much.